trotting through the patches of warm sunlight on his way down to the heap of applewood, he wondered again why Minister Chanbor had wanted to see Beata. She had certainly looked happy enough about it. Women seemed to go all giddy whenever they got a chance to meet the minister. Fitch didn't see what was so special about the man. After all, he was starting to get gray in his hair. He was old. Fitch couldn't imagine himself ever getting old enough to have gray hairs. Just thinking about it made his nose wrinkle with disgust. When he reached the woodpile, something caught his eye. He put a hand to his brow, shielding his eyes from the sunlight as he peered over to the shade of the turnround. He'd assumed it was just another delivery, but it was Brownie, still standing there with the butcher's cart. He'd been busy in the kitchen and had thought Beata would have left long ago. There were any number of doors out, and he would have no way of knowing when she'd left. He'd just assumed she had. It must have been an hour since she'd gone upstairs. Minister Chanbor probably wanted to give her a message for the butcher, some special request for his guests. Surely he would have finished with her long ago. So why was the cart still there? Fitch bent and plucked a stick of applewood. He shook his head in frustration. Minister Chanbor was probably telling her stories. Fitch hefted another billet from the woodpile. For some reason, women liked listening to the minister's stories, and he liked telling them. He was always talking to women, telling them stories. Sometimes at dinners and feasts, they gathered around him in giggling groups. Maybe they were just being polite. He was an important man, after all. No girls worried about being polite to him, and they never much liked listening to his stories, either. Fitch gathered up the armload of applewood and headed for the kitchen. He thought his stories about getting drunk were pretty funny, but girls weren't much interested in listening to them. Morley liked his stories, at least. Morley and the others who had pallets in the room where Fitch slept. They all liked telling each other stories, and they all liked to get drunk. There was nothing else to do on their rare time off from work and penance assembly. At least at penance assembly, they would sometimes talk to girls afterward if their work was done and they didn't have to get back to it. But Fitch, like the others, found assembly a depressing experience, hearing all those terrible things. Sometimes when they got back, if they could filch some wine or ale, they would get drunk. After Fitch had brought in a dozen armloads, Master Drummond snagged his sleeve and shoved a piece of paper into his hand. "Take this down to the brewer." Fitch bowed and said his yes, sir, before starting out. He couldn't read the paper, but since there was going to be a feast and he'd carried such papers in the past, he guessed the columns of writing were probably orders for what the kitchen wanted brought up. He was glad for the errand, because it didn't involve any real work, and give him a chance to get away from the heat and noise of the kitchen for a time, even if he did enjoy the aromas and could occasionally snatch a delicious scrap. All that tempting food was for guests, not the help. Sometimes, though, he just wanted away from the noise and confusion. The old brewer, his dark ender hair mostly gone and what was left mostly turned white, grunted as he read the paper Fitch handed him. Rather than sending Fitch on his way, the brewer wanted him to lug in some heavy sacks of trial hops. It was a common behest. Fitch was just a scullion, and so everyone had the right to order him to do work for them. He sighed, figuring it was the price for the slow walk he'd had, and the one he'd have on the way back. When he went out to the service doors where much of the estate goods were delivered, he noticed that across the way Brownie was still standing there with the butcher's cart. He was relieved to see, stacked to the side of the loading dock, that there were only 10 sacks to be lugged down to the brewery. When he'd finished with the sacks, he was sent on his way. Still catching his breath, he sauntered back through the service halls toward the kitchen, seeing few people and all but one of them Haken's servants, so he had only to pause to bow that once. Echoing footsteps swished back to him as he climbed the flight of stairs up to the main floor and the kitchen. Just before going through the door, he paused. He looked up at the stairwell's square ascent all the way to the third floor. No one was on the stairs. No one was in the halls. Master Drummond would believe him when he explained that the brewer wanted sacks brought in. Master Drummond was busy with preparations for that night's feast. He wouldn't bother asking how many sacks, and even if he did, he wasn't going to take the time to double-check. Fitch was taking the steps two at a time almost before he'd realized that he'd decided to go have himself a quick look. At what or for what, he wasn't sure. He'd been on the second floor only a few times, and the third floor only once, just the week before to take the minister's new aide, Dalton Campbell, an evening meal he'd ordered down to the kitchen. Fitch had been told by an Ander underling to leave the tray of sliced meats on the table in the empty office. The upper floors, in the west wing with the kitchen, where Fitch worked, was where a number of officials' offices were located. The minister's offices were supposed to be on the third floor. From the stories Fitch had heard, the minister had a number of offices. Why he would need more than one, Fitch couldn't guess. No one had ever explained it. The first and second floor of the West Wing, Fitch had heard it said, were where the vast Andreth Library was located. The library was a store of the land's rich and exemplary culture, drawing scholars and other important people to the estate. Andreth culture was a source of pride and the envy of all, Fitch had been taught. The third floor of the East Wing was the minister's family quarters. His daughter, younger than Fitch by maybe 2 or 3 years, and dirt plain, as Fitch heard it told, had gone off to an academy of some sort. He had only seen her from a distance, but he judged the description fair. Older servants sometimes whispered about an Ander guard who was put in chains because the minister's daughter, Marcy or Marcia, depending on who was telling the story, accused him of something. Fitch had heard versions running from he was doing nothing but standing quietly guarding in a hall, to eavesdropping on her, to rape. Voices echoed up the stairwell. Fitch paused with a foot on the next step, listening, every muscle stiff and still. As he remained motionless, it turned out to be someone passing along the first floor hall below. They weren't coming upstairs. Thankfully, the minister's wife, Lady Hildemara Chanbor, rarely came into the West Wing where Fitch worked. Lady Chanbor was one Ander who made even other Anders tremble. She had a foul temper and was never pleased with anyone or anything. She had dismissed staff just because they'd glanced up at her as they passed her in a hall. People who knew had told Fitch that Lady Chanbor had a face to match her temper, ugly. The unfortunate staff who had looked up at Lady Chanbor as they passed her in the hall were put out on the spot. Fitch learned they'd become beggars. Fitch had heard the women in the kitchen say that Lady Chanbor would go unseen for weeks because the minister would have enough of one thing or another from his wife and give her a black eye. Others said that she was just on a drunken binge. One old maid whispered that she went off with a lover from time to time. Fitch reached the top step. There was no one in the halls of the third floor. Sunlight streamed in windows trimmed with gauzy lace to fall across bare wooden floors. Fitch paused on the landing at the top of the stairs. It had doors on three sides and the stairs on the other to his back. He looked down empty halls running left and right, not knowing if he dared walk down them. He could be stopped by any number of people, from messengers to guards, and asked to explain what he was doing there. What could he say? Fitch didn't think he wanted to be a beggar. As much as he didn't like to work, he did like to eat. He seemed to always be hungry. The food wasn't as good as what was served to the important people of the household or to the guests, but it was decent, and he got enough. And when no one was watching, he and his friends did get to drink wine and ale. No, he didn't want to be put out to be a beggar. He took a careful step into the center of the landing. His knee almost buckled, and he nearly cried out as he felt something sharp stick him. There, under his bare foot, was a pin with a spiral end, the pin Beata used to close the collar of her dress. Fitch picked it up, not knowing what it could mean. He could take it and give it to her later, possibly to her joy to have it returned, but maybe not. Maybe he should leave it where he'd found it, rather than have to explain to anyone, Beata especially, how he'd come to have it. Maybe she'd want to know what he was doing going up there. She'd been invited, he hadn't. Maybe she'd think he'd been spying on her. He was bending to put the pin back when he saw movement, shadows, in the light coming from under one of the tall doors ahead. He cocked his head. He thought he heard Beata's voice, but he wasn't sure. He did hear muffled laughter. Fitch checked right and left again. He saw no one. It wouldn't be like he was going down a hall. He would just be stepping across the landing at the top of the stairs. If anyone asked, could say he was only intending to step into a hall to get a look at the view of the beautiful grounds from the third floor, to look out over the wheat fields that surrounded the capital city of Fairfield, the pride of Andereth. That seemed plausible to him. They might yell, but surely they wouldn't put him out, not for looking out a window, surely. His heart pounded, his knees trembled. Before he could consider if it was a foolish risk, he tiptoed across to the heavy four-panel door. He heard what sounded like a woman's whimpers, but he also heard chuckling and a man panting. Hundreds of little bubbles were preserved forever in the glass doorknob. There was no lock and so no keyhole beneath the ornate brass collar around the base of the glass knob. Putting his weight on his fingers, Fitch silently lowered himself to the floor until he was on his belly. The closer he got to the floor and the gap under the door, the better he could hear. It sounded like a man exerting himself somehow. The occasional chuckle was from a second man. Fitch heard a woman's choppy, plaintive sob, like she couldn't get a breath before it was gone. Beata, he thought. Fitch put his right cheek to the cold, varnished oak floor. He moved his face closer to the inch-tall opening under the door, seeing, as he did so, off a little to the left, chair legs, and before them, resting on the floor, one black boot ringed with silver studs. It moved just a little. Since there was only one, the man must have had his other foot crossed over the leg. Fitch's hair felt as if it stood on end. He clearly recalled seeing the owner of that boot. It was the man with the strange cape, with the rings, with all the weapons. The man who'd taken a long look at Beata as he passed her cart. Fitch couldn't see the source of the sounds. He silently snaked his body around and turned his face over to use his left eye to look under the door, off to the right. He slid closer until his nose touched the door. He blinked in disbelief and then again in horror. Beata was on her back on the floor. Her blue dress was bunched up around her waist. There was a man, his backside naked, between her bare, open legs, going at her fast and furious. Fitch sprang to his feet, jolted by what he'd seen. He retreated several steps. He panted, his eyes wide, his gut twisting with the shock of it, with the shock of having seen Beata's bare, open legs, with a minister between them. He turned to run down the stairs, tears stinging his eyes, his mouth hanging open, pulling for air like a carp out of water. Footsteps echoed. Someone was coming up. He froze in the middle of the room, 10 feet from the door, 10 feet from the steps, not knowing what to do. He heard the footsteps shuffling up the stairs. He heard two voices. He looked to the halls on each side, trying to decide if one might offer escape, if one or both might offer a dead end where he would be trapped, or guards who might throw him in chains. The two stopped on the landing below. It was two women, Ander women. They were gossiping about the feast that night. Who was going to be there, who wasn't invited, who was. Though their words were hardly more than whispered, in his stiff state of wide-eyed alarm he could make them out clear enough. Fitch's heart pounded in his ears as he panted in frozen panic, praying they wouldn't come up the stairs all the way to the third floor. The two fell to discussing what they were going to wear to catch Minister Chanbur's eye. Fitch could hardly believe he was hearing a conversation about how close above their nipples they dared wear their neckline. The image it put in Fitch's head would have been blindingly pleasant had he not been trapped and about to be caught where he shouldn't be, seeing something he shouldn't have seen, and maybe get himself put out on the street, or worse, much worse. One woman seemed bolder than the second. The second said she intended to be noticed, too, but didn't want more than that. The first chuckled and said she wanted more than to be noticed by the minister, and that the other shouldn't worry because either of their husbands would be lauded to have their wife catch the full attention of the minister. Fitch turned around to keep an eye on the minister's door. Someone had already caught the attention of the minister. Beata. Fitch took a careful step to the left. The floor creaked. He stilled, alert, his ears feeling like they were stretching big. The two below were giggling about their husbands. Fitch pulled back the foot. Sweat trickled down the back of his neck. The two below started moving as they talked. He held his breath. He heard a door squeak open. Fitch wanted to scream over his shoulder at them to hurry it up and go somewhere else to gossip. One of the women mentioned the other's husband, Dalton. The door closed behind them. Fitch exhaled. Right in front of him, the minister's door burst open. The big stranger had Beata by the upper arm. Her back was to Fitch as she was put out of the room. The man shoved her as if she weighed no more than a feather pillow. She landed on her bottom with a thud. She didn't know if Fitch was standing right behind her. The stranger's unconcerned gaze met Fitch's wide eyes. The man's thick mat of dark hair, entangled, stringy strands, hung to his shoulders. His clothes were dark, covered in leather plates and straps and belts. Most of his weapons were lying on the floor in the room. He looked a man who didn't need them, though, a man who could, with his big calloused hands, crush the throat of nearly anyone. When he turned back to the room, Fitch realized to his horror that the odd cape was made from scalps. That was why it looked like it was covered with patches of hair, because it was covered with patches of hair, human hair, every color from blonde to black. From beyond the doorframe, the minister called the stranger by name, Stein, and pitched him a small white handful of cloth. Stein caught it and then stretched Beata's underpants between two meaty fingers for a look. He tossed them into her lap as she sat on the floor struggling for breath, trying mightily not to cry. Stein looked up into Fitch's eyes, completely unconcerned, and smiled. His smile wrinkled aside his heavy mat of stubble. He gave Fitch a larking wink. Fitch was stunned by the man's disregard for someone being there, seeing what was happening. The minister peered out as he buttoned his trousers. He too smiled, and then pulled the door shut behind himself as he stepped out into the hall.
"Shall we visit the library now?"
Stein held out a hand in invitation.
"Lead the way, minister."
Beata sat hanging her head as the two men, chatting amicably, strode off down the hall to the left. She seemed crushed by the ordeal, too disillusioned to be able to muster the will to stand, to leave, to go back to her life the way it had been. Stock still, Fitch waited, hoping that somehow the impossible would happen, that maybe she wouldn't turn, that maybe she would be confused and wander off down the other hall, and she wouldn't notice him there behind her, unblinking, holding his breath. Sucking back her sobs, Beata staggered to her feet. When she turned and saw Fitch, she stiffened with a gasp. He stood paralyzed, wishing more than anything that he had never gone up the stairs for a look. He'd gotten considerably more of a look than he wanted.
"Beata,"
he wanted to ask if she was hurt, but of course she was hurt. He wanted to comfort her, but didn't know how, didn't know the right words to use. He wanted to take her in his arms and shelter her, but he feared she might misconstrue his aching concern. Beata's face warped from misery to blind rage. Her hand unexpectedly whipped around, striking his face with such fury that it made his head ring inside like a bell. A wallop wrenched his head to the side. The room swam in his vision. He thought he saw someone in the distance down a hall, but he wasn't sure. As he tried to get his bearings to grope for a railing as he staggered back, his hand found the floor instead. One knee joined his hand on the floor. He saw a blur of her blue dress as Beata raced down the stairs, the staccato sounds of her footfalls hammering an echo up the stairwell. Dazing pain, sharp and hot, drove into his upper jaw just in front of his ringing ear. His eyes hurt. He was stupefied by how hard she had hit him. Nausea bloated in the pit of his stomach. He blinked, trying to force his vision to clear. A hand under his arm startled him. It helped lift him back to his feet. Dalton Campbell's face loomed close to his. Unlike the other two men, he did not smile, but, rather, studied Fitch's eyes the way Master Drummond scrutinized a halibut brought in by the fishmonger just before he gutted it.
"What is your name?"
"Fitch, sir. I work in the kitchen, sir."
Between the punch and his dread, Fitch's legs felt like boiled noodles. The man glanced toward the stairs.
"You seem to have wandered from the kitchen, don't you think?"
"I took a paper to the brewer."
Fitch paused to gulp air, trying to make his voice stop trembling.
"I was just on my way back to the kitchen, sir."
The hand tightened on Fitch's arm, drawing him closer.
"Since you were rushing to the brewer, down on the lower level, and then right back to the kitchen on the first floor, you must be a hard-working young man."
"I would have no reason to recall seeing you up here on the third floor."
He released Fitch's arm.
"I suppose I recall seeing you downstairs, rushing back to the kitchen from the brewer, without wandering off anywhere along the way?"
Fitch's concern for Beata turned to a focused hope to keep himself from being thrown out of the house, or worse.
Yes, sir. I'm on my way right back to the kitchen."
Dalton Campbell draped his hand over the hilt of his sword.
"You've been working, and haven't seen a thing, have you?"
Fitch swallowed his terror.
"No, sir. Nothing. I swear. Just that Minister Chanbor smiled at me. He's a great man, the minister. I'm thankful that a man so great as he would give work to a worthless Haken such as myself."
The corners of Dalton Campbell's mouth turned up just enough that Fitch thought the aide might be pleased by what he'd heard. His fingers drummed along the length of the brass crossguard of his sword. Fitch stared at the lordly weapon. He felt driven to speak into the silence.
"I want to be good and be a worthy member of the household, to work hard, to earn my keep."
The smile widened.
"That is indeed good to know.
You seem a fine young man.
Perhaps, since you are so earnest in your desire, I could count on you?"
Fitch wasn't sure exactly what he was to be counted on for, but he gave a yes, sir, anyway, and without hesitation.
"Since you swear you didn't see anything on your way back to the kitchen, you are proving to me that you are a lad of potential, perhaps one who could be entrusted with more responsibility."
"Responsibility, sir?"
Dalton Campbell's dark eyes gleamed with a terrifying, incomprehensible intelligence
the kind Fitch imagined the mice must see in the eyes of the house cats. We sometimes have need of people desiring to move up in the household. We will see. Keep yourself vigilant against the lies of people wishing to bring disrepute to the minister, and we will see.
Yes, sir. I'd not like to hear anyone say anything against the minister. He's a good man, the minister. I hope the rumors I've heard are true, that one day we might be blessed enough by the Creator that Minister Chanbur would become sovereign.
Now the aide's smile truly did take hold.
Yes, I do believe you have potential.
Should you hear any lies about the minister, I would appreciate knowing about it. He gestured toward the stairs. Now you had best get back to the kitchen.
Yes, sir. If I hear any such thing, I'll bring it to you.
Fitch made for the stairs.
I'd not want anyone lying about the minister. That would be wrong.
The young man. Fitch, was it? Fitch turned back from the top step.
Yes, sir. Fitch.
Dalton Campbell crossed his arms and turned his head to peer with one questioning eye.
What have you learned at Penance about protecting the sovereign?
The sovereign?
Fitch rubbed his palms on his trousers.
Well, that anything done to protect our sovereign is a virtue?
Very good.
Arms still folded, he leaned toward Fitch.
And since you have heard that Minister Chanbur is likely to be named sovereign, then...
The man expected an answer. Fitch groped wildly for it. He cleared his throat at last.
Well, I guess that if he's to be named sovereign, then maybe he ought to be protected the same?
By the way, Dalton Campbell smiled as he straightened his back. Fitch knew he'd hit upon the right answer.
You may indeed have potential to move up in the household.
Thank you, sir. I would do anything to protect the minister, seeing as how he'll be sovereign one day. It's my duty to protect him in any way I can.
Yes,
Dalton Campbell drawled in an odd way. He cocked his head cat-like as he considered Fitch.
If you prove to be helpful in whatever way we might need in order to protect the minister, it would go a long way toward clearing your debt.
Fitch's ears perked up.
My debt, sir?
Like I told Morley, if he proves to be of use to the minister, it might be that he could even earn himself a surname and a certificate signed by the sovereign to go with it. You seem a bright lad. I would expect no less might be in your future.
Fitch's jaw hung open. Earning a surname was one of his dreams. A certificate signed by the sovereign proved to all that Ahakin had paid his debt and was to be recognized with a surname and respected. His mind tumbled backward to what he'd just heard.
Morley? Scullion Morley?
Yes. Didn't he tell you I talked to him?
Fitch scratched behind an ear, trying to imagine that Morley would have kept such astonishing news from him.
Well, no, sir. He never said nothing. He's about my best friend. I'd recall if he'd said such a thing. And I'm sorry, but he never did.
Dalton Campbell stroked a finger against the silver of the scabbard at his hip as he watched Fitch's eyes.
I told him not to mention it to anyone.
He arched an eyebrow. That kind of loyalty pays plums. I expect no less from you. You understand, Fitch? Fitch surely did.
Not a soul, just like Morley. I got it, Master Campbell.
Dalton Campbell nodded as he smiled to himself.
Good.
He again rested a hand on the hilt of his magnificent sword.
You know, Fitch, when Ahakin has his debt paid and earns his surname, that signed certificate entitles him to carry a sword.
Fitch's eyes widened.
It does? I never knew.
The tall Ander smiled a stately farewell, and with a noble flourish, turned and started off down the hall.
Back to work then, Fitch. Glad to have made your acquaintance. Perhaps we will speak again one day.
Before anyone else caught him up there, Fitch raced down the stairs. Confounding thoughts swirled through his head. Thinking again about Beata and what had happened, he just wanted the day to end so he could get himself good and drunk. He ached with sorrow for Beata. But it was the minister she admired, the minister who would someday be sovereign that Fitch had seen on her. Besides, she struck him, a terrible thing for Ahakin to do, even to another Ahakin, although he wasn't certain the prohibition extended to women. But even if it didn't, that wouldn't make him feel any less miserable about it. For some unfathomable reason, she hated him now. He ached to get drunk. Chapter 16
Fetch! Here, boy! Fetch!
Usually, when Master Drummond called him by that name, Fitch knew he blushed with humiliation, but this time he was in such anguish over what he had seen upstairs earlier that he hardly felt any shame over so petty a thing. Master Drummond's talking down to him as if he were dirt could not match Beata's hating him and hitting him. It had been a couple of hours, but his face still throbbed where she'd clouded him, so he was clear on that much of it. She hated him. It confused and confounded him, but he was sure she hated him. It seemed to him she should be angry at someone, anyone besides him. Angry at herself, maybe, for going up there in the first place. But he guessed she couldn't very well have refused to go see the minister if he asked for her. Then Inger the butcher would have thrown her out when the minister told him that his Haken girl refused to go up to take his special request. No, she couldn't very well have done that. Besides, she wanted to meet the man. She told him she did. Fitch knew, though, that she never expected he would have his way with her. Maybe it wasn't the minister she was so distraught about. Fitch remembered that man Stein winking at him. She was up there a long time. That was still no reason for her to hate Fitch or to hit him. Fitch came to a halt. His fingers throbbed from having them in scalding water for so long, scrubbing and scraping. The rest of him felt sick and numb, except, of course, his face.
"Yes, sir?"
Master Drummond opened his mouth to speak, but then closed it and instead leaned down. He frowned. "What happened to your face?"
"One of the billets of apple slipped and hit me as I picked up an armload, sir."
Master Drummond shook his head as he wiped his hands on his white towel.
"Idiot," he muttered. "Only an idiot," he said in a voice loud enough for others to hear, "would hit himself in the face with a stick of wood as he picked it up."
"Yes, sir."
Master Drummond was just about to speak when Dalton Campbell, studying a well-used piece of paper covered with messy lines of writing, glided up beside Fitch. He had a whole stack of disheveled papers, their curled and crumpled edges protruding every which way. He followed down the writing with one finger as he nested the papers in the crook of his other arm.
"Drummond, I came to make sure of a few items," he said without looking up.
Master Drummond quickly finished at wiping his hands and then straightened his broad back.
Yes, sir, Mr. Campbell. Whatever I can do for you."
The minister's aide lifted the paper to peer at a second sheet beneath.
"Have you seen to putting the best platters and ewers in the ambry?"
"Yes, Mr. Campbell."
Dalton muttered absently to himself about how they must have been changed after he'd looked. He scanned the paper and then flipped to a third piece.
"You will need to make two additional places at the high table."
He flipped back to the second page. Master Drummond's mouth twisted in agitation.
"Two more. Yes, Mr. Campbell. If you could, in the future, would you kindly let me know such as this a little earlier in the day?"
Dalton Campbell's finger flicked at the air, but his eyes never left his papers.
"Yes, yes, only too happy to do so. If the minister informs me of it sooner, that is."
He tapped a place in his papers and looked up.
"Lady Chanbor objects to the musicians' stomachs grumbling along with their music. Please see to it that they are fed something first this time, especially the harpist. She will be closest to Lady Chanbor."
Master Drummond dipped his head in acknowledgment.
"Yes, Mr. Campbell, I will see to it."
Fitch, ever so slowly, so as not to be obvious, slipped backward a couple of paces, keeping his head down, trying not to appear as if he were listening to the minister's aide giving the kitchen master instructions. He wished he could leave rather than risk being thought a snoop, but he knew he'd be yelled at if he left without being sent off, so he compromised at trying to be inconspicuous but at hand. "And the spiced wine, there needs to be more of a variety this time. Some people thought last time's selection skimpy. Hot and cold both, please." Master Drummond pressed his lips together.
"Short notice, Mr. Campbell. If you could in the future..."
"Yes, yes, if I'm informed, so will be you."
He flipped over another page.
"Dainties. They are to be served at the head table only, until they have had their fill. Last time the minister was embarrassed to discover them gone, and some guests at his table left wanting more. Let the other tables go wanting first, if for some reason you have been unable to acquire a proper supply."
Fitch remembered that incident, too, and he knew that this time Master Drummond had ordered more of the deer testicles fried up. Fitch had pilfered one of the treats as he took the fry pan to be washed. Although he had to eat it without the sweet and sour sauce, it was still good. As Dalton Campbell checked his papers, he asked questions about different salts, butters, and breads, and gave Master Drummond a few more corrections to the dinner. Fitch, as he waited, trying not to watch the two men, watched instead the woman at a nearby table make the pig's stomachs,
stuffed with ground meats, cheeses, eggs, and spices, into hedgehogs by covering them with almond spines. At another table, two women were re-feathering roasted peacocks with feathers colored by saffron and yellow turnsole. Even the beaks and claws were colored, so that the newly plumed birds looked like spectacular creatures of gold, like gold statues, only more lifelike. Dalton Campbell, at last seeming to finish with his list of questions and instructions, lowered his arms, one hand loosely holding the hand holding the papers.
"Is there anything you would like to report, Drummond?"
The kitchen master licked his lips, seeming not to know what the aide was talking about.
"No, Mr. Campbell."
"And everyone in your kitchen, then, is doing their job to your satisfaction?" His face was blank of emotion. Fitch saw eyes in the room cautiously turn up for a quick peek. The work going on all about seemed to grow quieter. He could almost see ears getting bigger. It seemed to Fitch like maybe Dalton Campbell was working around the edges of accusing Master Drummond of not running a good kitchen by allowing lazy people to avoid their duties and then failing to punish them. The kitchen master seemed to suspect the same accusation.
"Well, yes, sir, they are doing their job to my satisfaction. I keep them in line, Mr. Campbell. I'll not have slackers ruining the workings of my kitchen. I couldn't have that. This is too important a household to allow any sluggard to spoil things. I don't allow it. No, sir, I don't."
Dalton Campbell nodded his pleasure at hearing this.
"Very good, Drummond. I, too, would not like to have slackers in the household."
He scanned the room of silent, quietly hard-working people.
"Very well. Thank you, Drummond. I will check back later before it's time to begin serving."
Master Drummond bowed his head.
"Thank you, Mr. Campbell."
The minister's aide turned and started to leave, and as he did so, he caught sight of Fitch standing there. As he frowned, Fitch lowered his head on his shoulders even more, wishing he could melt into the cracks in the wood floor. Dalton Campbell glanced back over his shoulder at the kitchen master.
"What is this scullion's name?"
"Fitch, Mr. Campbell."
"Fitch? Ah, I get it then. And how long has he worked in the household?"
"Some 4 years, Mr. Campbell."
"4 years, that long?"
He turned fully around to face Master Drummond.
"And is he a slacker, then, who ruins the workings of your fine kitchen? One who should have been put out of the household long ago, but has not been for some mysterious reason? You haven't been overlooking your responsibility as kitchen master, allowing a slacker to be under the minister's roof, have you? Are you truly guilty of such dereliction?"
Fitch stood in frozen terror, wondering if he would be beaten before they threw him out, or if they would simply show him the door and send him away without so much as a morsel of food. Master Drummond's gaze flicked back and forth between Fitch and the aide.
Well, no, sir. No, Mr. Campbell. I see to it that Fitch pulls his share of the load. I'd not let him be a slacker under the minister's roof, no, sir."
Dalton Campbell peered back at Fitch with a puzzling expression. He looked once again to the kitchen master.
"Well, then, if he does as you ask and does his work, I see no reason to demean the young man by calling him Fetch, do you? Don't you think that reflects badly on you, Drummond, as kitchen master?"
Very good, then. I'm glad you agree. We'll have no more of that kind of thing in the household." Either with stealth or bold intent, nearly every eye in the kitchen was on the exchange between the two men. The fact was not lost on the kitchen master.
"Well, now, just a minute, if you don't mind. No real harm is meant, and the boy doesn't mind, do you now, Fitch?"
Dalton Campbell's posture changed in a way that halted the words in Master Drummond's mouth before they could finish coming out. The noble-looking aide's dark ander eyes took on a dangerous gleam. He seemed suddenly taller, his shoulders broader, his muscles more evident under his fine dark blue doublet and quilted jerkin. His off-handed, distracted, casual, and at times stuffy official tone was suddenly gone. He transformed into a threat as deadly-looking as the weapon at his hip.
"Let me put it another way to you, Drummond. We'll not have that sort of thing under this roof. I expect you to comply with my wishes. If I ever again hear you demean any of our staff by calling them by names intended to be humiliating, I will have a new kitchen master and you put out. Is that clear?"
"Yes, sir. Very clear. Thank you, sir."
Campbell started to leave but turned back, his whole person conveying the image of menace.
"One other thing. Minister Chanbor gives me orders and I carry them out without fail. That is my job. I give you orders and you carry them out without fail. That is your job. I expect the boy to do his work or be put out.
But you put him out, and you had better be prepared to provide proof of why. And moreover, if you make it hard on him because of my orders, then I will not put you out, but instead I will gut you and have you roasted on that spit over there. Now, is all that absolutely clear, Mr. Drummond? Fitch hadn't known Master Drummond's eyes could go so wide. Sweat beaded all over his forehead. He swallowed before he spoke.
Yes, sir. Absolutely clear. It will be as you say. You have my word.
Dalton Campbell seemed to shrink back to his normal size, which was not small to begin with. The pleasant expression returned to his face, including the polite smile.
Thank you, Drummond. Carry on.
Not once during the exchange had Dalton Campbell looked at Fitch, nor did he as he turned and strode out of the kitchen. Along with Master Drummond and half the people in the kitchen, Fitch let out his breath. When he thought again about what had just happened, and he realized for the first time, really, that Master Drummond would no longer be calling him Fetch, he was overcome with a weak-kneed astonishment. He suddenly thought very highly of Dalton Campbell. Pulling his white towel from behind his belt and blotting his forehead, Master Drummond noticed people watching.
Back to work, all of you.
He replaced the towel.
Fitch, he called in a normal voice,
just like when he called the other people in his kitchen. Fitch took two quick steps forward.
Yes, sir.
He gestured.
We need some more oak. Not as much as the last time, about half that much. Be quick about it now.
Yes, sir.
Fitch ran for the door, eager to get the wood, not even caring about the splinters he might get. He would never again have to be humiliated by that hated name. People would not laugh at him over it, all because of Dalton Campbell. At that moment, Fitch would have carried hot coals in his bare hands if Dalton Campbell asked it, and smiled all the way. Chapter 17. Unbuttoning the top button of his doublet, Dalton Campbell, with his other hand, nudged the tall mahogany door to their quarters until he felt the latch click home. At once, the balm of quiet began to soothe him. It had been a long day, and it was far from over. There was still the feast to attend.
Teresa, he called across the sitting room back toward the bedroom. It's me.
He wished they could stay in and make love. His nerves needed the diversion. Later, perhaps, if business didn't interfere. He unfastened another button and tugged open the collar as he yawned. Fragrance of lilacs filled his lungs. Heavy blue moire drapes at the far windows were drawn against the darkening sky, leaving the room to perfumed mellow lamplight, scented candles, and the flickering glow of a low fire in the hearth, burning for the cheer it brought rather than the need of heat. He noted the dark violet carpet and its sweet-colored fringe looked freshly brushed. The gilded chairs were angled to show off the tawny leather seats and backs as they posed beside elegant tables set with lush sprays of fresh flowers. The plush throws and pillows on the couches were set just so, the deliberate precision meant to convey a casual intimacy with luxury. Dalton expected his wife to oversee the staff and ensure that the quarters were kept presentable for business as well as entertaining, which were, although approached differently, one and the same. Teresa would know that with a feast that night, it was even more likely he would ask someone back to their apartments, someone important. That could be anyone from a dignitary to an inconspicuous pair of eyes and ears. They were all important in their own way, all meshing into the cobweb he worked, listening, watching for any tiny little tug. Crowded feasts were concentrated confusion, alive with drinking, conversation, commotion, and emotion. They often provided opportunities to forge alliances, reinforce loyalties, or enforce fealties, to tend his cobweb. Teresa stuck her head past the doorframe, grinning her joy upon seeing him.
There's my sweetheart.
Despite the weary mood enveloping him as he had closed the door behind, shutting out the day's troubles if only for the moment, he smiled helplessly at her dark, sparkling eyes.
Tess, my darling, your hair looks grand.
A gold comb decorated the front lift of the full top. The wealth of dangling dark tresses were tied with an abundance of sequined gold ribbons that added to her hair's length, almost forming a collar. Parting as she leaned forward, the sparkling strips teasingly revealed her graceful neck. In her mid-20s, she was younger than he by nearly 10 years. Dalton thought her a ravishing creature beyond compare, a bonus to her allure of trenchant commitment to objectives. He could scarcely believe that a short 6 months ago she had finally and at long last become his wife.
Others had been in contention, some of greater standing, but none with more ambition. Dalton Campbell was not a man to be denied. Anyone who took him lightly came to a day of reckoning when they learned better than to underestimate him or came to regret the mistake. Nearly a year ago, when he had asked her to be his wife, she had quizzed him, asking in that velvet, bantering manner of hers that often cloaked the steel of her aims, if he was really a man who intended on going places, as she certainly meant to rise up in the world. At the time, he had been an assistant to the magistrate in Fairfield, not an unimportant job, but only a convenient port as far as he was concerned, a place to gather his resources and cultivate connections. He had not played into her chafing questions, but instead assured her in all sobriety that he was a man on the way up, and no other man she was seeing, despite his present station, had any chance of approaching Dalton Campbell's future stature. She had been taken aback by his solemn declaration. It wiped the smile off her face. On the spot, in the spell of his conviction, the truth of his purpose, she consented to marry him. She had been pleased to learn the reliability of his predictions. As plans proceeded for their wedding, he was awarded a better appointment. In their first few months of marriage, they had moved 3 times, always to improved quarters, and as a result of advanced positions. The public, who had cause to know of him, either because of his reputation or because of their dealings with Andorath government, valued his keen understanding of Andorath law. Dalton Campbell was widely recognized for his brilliant insight into the complexities of the law, the fortress bedrock it was built upon, the intricate structure of its wisdom and precedent, and the scope of its protective walls. The men for whom Dalton worked appreciated his vast understanding of the law, but valued most his knowledge of the law's arcane passages, burrows, and obscure openings out of dark traps and corners. They also valued his ability to swiftly abandon the law when the situation required a different solution, one the law couldn't provide. In such cases, he was just as inventive and just as effective. In no more time than a snap of the fingers, it seemed, Teresa easily adjusted to the ameliorated circumstances in which she regularly found herself, taking up the novel task of directing household staff with the aplomb of one who had been doing it for the whole of her life. Only weeks before, he had won the top post at the minister's estate. Teresa had been jubilant to learn they would be taking on luxurious quarters in such a prestigious place. She now found herself a woman of standing among women of rank and privilege. She might have been overjoyed, nearly tearing off his clothes to have him on the spot when he told her the news, but the truth be known, she had expected no less. If there was one person who shared his ruthless ambition, it was Teresa. "Oh, Dalton, will you tell me what dignitaries will be at the feast? I can't stand the suspense a moment longer." He yawned again as he stretched. He knew she had her own cobwebs to tend. "Boring dignitaries. But the minister will be there."
"Yes."
"Well, silly, he's not boring. And I've gotten to know some of the women, the wives of the estate. They're all grand people. Good as I could have hoped. Their husbands are all important." She touched the tip of her tongue to her upper lip in a sly, teasing gesture. "Just not as important as my husband."
"Tess, my darling," he said with a smile, "you could inspire a dead man to become important for you." She winked and then disappeared.
"There were several messages slipped under the door for you," she called back from the other room. "They're in the desk." The elegant desk in the corner glowed like a dark gem. Made of polished elm burl, each panel of quartered, book-matched veneer was outlined with diamond-patterned banding of alternating plain and dyed maple. Each dark diamond was inset with a dot of gold. The legs were varnished to a deep luster rather than gilded, as were the legs of most of the other furniture in the room. In a secret compartment behind an upper drawer, there were several sealed messages. He broke the seals and scanned each message, assessing its importance. Some were of interest, but none were urgent. They mostly meant to pass along information, little vibrations from every corner of his cobweb. One reported an odd and apparently accidental drowning in a public fountain. It had happened in early afternoon as crowds regularly passed the landmark in the Square of the Martyrs. Even though it had been daylight and in full view of everyone, no one noticed until it was too late. Having seen similar messages of unexplained deaths of late, Dalton knew the unspoken implication of the message was an admonition that it might have been some sort of a vendetta involving magic, but made to look like an unfortunate accident. One mentioned only a
perturbed lady reporting that she was restless and that she had written a missive to a director asking for a moment of his time in private at the feast and asking him to keep her letter confidential. Dalton knew the woman to whom the message referred, and because of that, he knew also it would be Director Linscott to whom she had written.
The person writing the message for him knew better than to write down names. He suspected the reason for the restless part. It was the desire for the private meeting that concerned him. The message said the woman's letter was somehow lost and never delivered. Dalton slipped the messages back into the compartment for later review and replaced the drawer. He was going to have to do something about the woman, what he didn't know yet. Overreacting could sometimes cause as much trouble as doing nothing. It might be he need only give the woman an ear, let her vent her pique, as perhaps she meant to do with Director Linscott. Dalton could just as easily hear her grievance. Someone, somewhere in his intricate cobweb of contacts, would give him the bit of information he needed to make the right decision, and if not, talking to the woman in a reassuring manner might smooth things enough to give him the direction he needed.